Hello and welcome to another edition of Alternative Press Review. I'm Randy Goodlungen. This week we're continuing in the double issue of The Nation magazine. This is for July 29th and August 5th. We're going to start with the editorial page for an essay titled The Court, Grave of Liberty. This is written by Eric Foner. That's F-O-N-E-R. The Supreme Court's recent decision refusing to interfere with extreme partisan gerrymandering not only seriously undermines our already fragile democracy, it also brings to mind the Court's acquiescence more than a century ago in laws that denied the right to vote to millions of black Southerners. In particular, it is reminiscent of the Court's 1903 ruling in Giles v. Harris, a largely forgotten case in which the justices, as today, claimed they were not authorized to adjudicate political matters. In that case, Jackson W. Giles, the president of the Colored Men's Suffrage Association, sued to overturn voting requirements openly designed to disenfranchise black voters in Alabama after Reconstruction. The state's constitution of 1901 allowed registrars to bar from voting those who lacked, quote-unquote, good character, or did not understand the duties and obligations of citizenship. The result was that almost every black voter was eliminated from the rolls, despite the fact that the 15th Amendment, ratified in 1870, prohibited states from denying the right to vote because of race. To work around that amendment, Alabama's requirements did not explicitly mention race. It was clear, as Giles's complaint argued, that the state's entire registration system was racially biased. Oliver Wendell Holmes, recently appointed to the court by Theodore Roosevelt, wrote the opinion for the majority after a 6-3 vote. Like Chief Justice John Roberts today, Holmes threw up his hands and described the Supreme Court as impotent. If the great mass of the white population intends to keep the blacks from voting, he wrote, there was nothing the justices could do about it. The courts were not permitted to get involved in politics. Relief from a great political wrong could come only from the people of a state through their elected officials or from Congress. He ignored the fact that the definition of the people of Alabama was precisely the point at issue. Holmes would go on to have a distinguished judicial career. Giles v. Harris, one scholar wrote, is, or should be, the most prominent stain on his reputation. Roberts, take note. Like Republicans today, the white Southern press in 1903 hailed the ruling as an indication that the Supreme Court would not interfere with a sovereign state's regulation of its elections. Some signs of discontent appeared in the North. Is the Constitution non-enforceable? Asked the Springfield, Massachusetts Republican. We are brought face to face with the consideration that the Constitution may be violated with impunity. The idea that the Supreme Court does not have the authority to get involved in political matters would be laughable if the results of this decision were not so damaging. Was not Baker v. Carr, the one-man, one-vote decision of the 1960s, political? What about Bush v. Gore in 2000, which decided the outcome of a presidential election? Roberts claims that the founders, by leaving the drawing of district lines to state legislatures, anticipated political involvement in the process. But the founders did not expect or desire the rise of political parties that sought to warp the electoral process to their advantage. As Richard Hofstadter demonstrated many years ago in The Idea of a Party System, The founders thought political parties were divisive institutions, indifferent, or hostile to the common good. They would have been appalled to see a political party use its control of districting to override the will of the state's voters. Supreme Court decisions have practical consequences which justices too often blithely ignore. It took well over half a century for the right to vote to be restored to black citizens of the southern states via the Voting Rights Act of 1965. During those years, the country experienced profound social and economic changes, which the disenfranchised billions in the South had no voice in shaping. Needless to say, the right to vote is still being fought out in numerous states at this very moment. What is the difference between being denied access to the ballot box and living in a district designed so that your party is guaranteed to lose? Our Constitution is not self-enforcing. At certain moments in our history, a Supreme Court has used its authority to protect constitutional rights when legislatures and Congress abdicate this responsibility. At other times, as one lawyer wrote in 1890, the court becomes the grave of liberty. That seems to be where we are headed today. That was the editorial page written by Eric Foner, taken from the July 29th and August 5th double issue of The Nation. Turning now to the second essay under the editorial section of this publication, we have a piece written by Aaron Skinner. That first name is A-R-R-A-N, last name just as it sounds, S-K-I-N-N-E-R. Aaron Skinner is a multimedia specialist working in international communications on issues including the refugee crisis and the conflicts in Syria, Yemen, and Western Sahara. His essay is titled, On Not Looking Away. To combat complicity, we must confront tragedy. I can't get the image out of my mind. I received this text from my wife hours after seeing the photo of Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez and his 23-year-old daughter, Angie Valera, drowned in the Rio Grande. For the next 48 hours, the devastating photo was everywhere we looked. When my wife says she can't handle looking at such awful images, I know how she feels. As the creative advisor at Independent Diplomat, a non-profit that supports democratic groups and opposition movements fighting opposition, I've spent years working with images coming out of Syria, trying to draw the public's attention to the tragedy that has been unfolding there. And I am the father of a 21-month-old, so I am understandably affected by what I see, photographs and videos of children pulled from the rubble after indiscriminate barrel bomb attacks, babies struggling for their last breath after chemical weapons strikes. Images of victims from the regime's torture chambers, their eyes and genitals gouged out. Horrific things done to the human body that I did not think possible. I wasn't always aware of such horrors myself. Until 9/11, I was a struggling figurative painter working security at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. I had no interest in anything outside my bubble until I saw images of people making the impossible choice and jumping to their deaths. Those images, which were later censored, shook me awake. I switched careers, and in my new role, I was one of the first people to see the Caesar photos, evidence of war atrocities committed by the Syrian regime that the world has so far paid little attention to. When my wife and others ask how I deal with viewing such graphic imagery, I'm not sure I can answer. I feel the same sense of hopelessness, anger, and impotence, I want to turn away too. And yet I've learned to put those feelings inside. While I empathize with the people in the images, human beings fleeing bombs and destruction, many of them parents like me or children the same age as mine, I recognize it's not about me. In the essay, A Too Perfect Picture, Teju Cole compares the outsider's view of India with the natives, remarking that Westerners cannot help overlaying our agendas and prejudices when photographing another culture. Art is always difficult, he contends, but it is especially difficult when it comes to telling other people's stories. And it is ferociously difficult when those others are tangled up in your history and you are tangled up in theirs. We see this clearly in the photos we choose of refugees, always the victims, lost at sea in orange life jackets, imprisoned, caged, passive. While it's important to show the tragedy, we also need to show refugees not merely as victims, but as people with agency and volition. This is a demand made by the refugees I've worked for. The Network for Refugee Voices and the Global Refugee-Led Network, for example, are two coalitions demanding to have their voices heard on matters that affect their community, to have control over their own stories. These activists, journalists, and storytellers share everything, not just the stories and images that corroborate their accounts of the crimes committed against them, but also evidence of their humanity and positive contributions to our societies. Their lives look just like ours. I no longer work on Syria, but the images still flood my timeline. A WhatsApp group still pings several times daily as the regime and Russia bomb civilians in Idlib. The world does not seem to be interested in these images, or rather, these lives. The victims of such atrocities are at a loss to comprehend not only that such awful crimes are being committed against them and that the evidence of such crimes exists, but also that we are choosing to ignore this evidence and to look away. In the West, we have created a media environment that protects us from the graphic realities of our world. But sometimes we are forced to look at it. In 2015, the heartbreaking photo of 3-year-old Alan Kurdi, his tiny corpse washed up on a Mediterranean shore, made global headlines. Now the image of a drowned man with his daughter, their bodies an indictment of us all, filters through our algorithms again and shakes us awake for a day or so, until the discussion devolves into the question of whether or not we should look. How do we deal with images that affect us so deeply? What is our responsibility to those shown in them? Do we have an obligation to look? These are questions that photographers and editors grapple with daily. The Guardian's Roger Tooth writes about the struggle of choosing which pictures he will use and his responsibility to the viewers and the victims. These are questions I've wrestled with while trying to raise the alarm about atrocities and abuses in Syria. At the start of his essay, Tooth writes, "We wanted to show the readers the reality of life and death in Gaza, but we didn't want to shock or unnecessarily upset them." How do you convey a shocking reality without shocking the viewer? You can't. We shouldn't. To do so forsakes our own humanity as well as theirs. When we turn away, we find ourselves siding with the perpetrator. According to psychiatrist Judith Lewis Herman, society is set up to conspire with the perpetrator, to ignore their crimes and pretend they didn't happen, because otherwise we would have to do something, which is a bigger inconvenience. If we don't even look, how can we uninformed public demand action. All the perpetrator asks is that the bystander do nothing, Herman writes. He appeals to the universal desire to hear, to see, and speak no evil. The victim, on the contrary, asks the bystander to share the burden of pain. The victim demands action, engagement, and remembering. As bystanders in the media, we can no longer make it our job to attempt to filter the conversation, to be the arbiter of images. As Tooth says, it's all out there on the internet or on your timeline. Even when we try to censor, the images still exist on Twitter, on Reddit, on WhatsApp. We need to face these images and listen to the stories they tell and to share. That was taken from the editorial section of The Nation magazine. It was written by Aaron Skinner. He's a multimedia specialist working in international communications on issues including the refugee crisis and the conflicts in Syria, Yemen, and the Western Sahara. You're listening to Alternative Press Review. I'm Randy Goodbungen. Continuing now in this double issue of The Nation magazine, we hear an essay written by Katha Pollitt, who is a regular writer for The Nation. Her last name is spelled P-O-L-L-I-T-T. Her first name is K-A-T-H-A. Her piece is titled, Take Back the Streets. It's 2019. Where have all the protesters gone? Remember 2017? Those were the days. In Trump's first year, we marched and demonstrated constantly for women's rights, for immigrants, for science, for the planet, and for the release of his tax returns. We jammed the airports to protest the Muslim travel ban, subscribed to civic action sites like Five Calls, and made phoning and postcarding part of our daily routines. We confronted Republican lawmakers at their own town halls, and even picked the homes of Democrats like Senator Chuck Schumer, who seemed too eager to compromise with Trump. Inevitably, and rightly, protest turned into politics, and the patient, sometimes frustrating, local organizing that electing new leaders requires. We took back the House and made important progress in the states, including Virginia, New Mexico, New York, and Maine. Black voters mobilized, and so did the Democratic Socialists of America, Indivisible and Vote Run Lead. On the ground, going door to door, the mostly suburban, mostly white women of the resistance, mocked by a self-described dirtbag leftist as middle-aged hysterics, sought to outmobilize the 52% of white women who voted for Trump in the first place. These efforts achieved wonders, including the election of the charismatic Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and victories for black House candidates in mostly white districts, such as Lucy Macbeth, Lauren Underwood, Johanna Hayes, and Antonio Delgado. Among the many local progressive triumphs, Chicago elected Lori Lightfoot as its first openly gay black mayor. There are now no fewer than 6 DSA, or Democratic Socialist of America, members on the 50-member Chicago City Council. All this is crucial. But what happened to the fierce urgency that barely 24 months ago sent us pouring into the streets at a moment's notice. 2.5 years into this term, Trump has not moved an inch. He is the same cruel and ignorant liar, bigot, and bully he has been since his youth. He has learned nothing in office. He still lacks a grasp of the basic civics and government that we were taught in 8th grade, such as what tariffs actually do. He just keeps pushing the limits, always on the attack and holding his ridiculous rallies, sending out his bizarre and misspelled spiteful tweets, blaming the Democrats for things he himself is responsible for, and appointing weirdos and randos to important positions. His chief of protocol, Sean Lawler, just resigned in the wake of reports that he intimidated staffers and carried a whip in the office. None of it makes a dent. As I write, a Washington Post ABC News poll puts Trump's approval rating at a record high 44% amid the children in cages, the restrictions on abortion and birth control, huge tax cuts for the rich, an erratic foreign policy that may get us into war with Iran, and somewhere between 16 and 24 women accusing him of sexual assault or misconduct, including, per E. Jean Carroll's remarkable essay in New York Magazine, outright rape. In France, the Yellow Vests have come to Paris for 34 consecutive Saturdays to protest an increase in gas taxes, rally against a lowered speed limit on country roads, and ask for a raise in the minimum wage, to name just a few issues. They won on all of those demands. In Hong Kong, 1 in 7 residents, 1 in 7, took to the streets over a law permitting extradition to mainland China. The bill has been shelved, and Carrie Lam, the territory's chief executive, apologized. Why isn't anything like that happening here? There are activists who inspire awe with their dedication and courage, like the volunteers who risk arrest in the Arizona desert to provide migrants with water, food, and shelter. There are wonderful organizations, like RACES, that provide them with legal aid and other help. There's Me Too, which, far from having run out of steam, gets a new life every time a case of assault or rape makes headlines. Carol wrote that it inspired her to come forward after more than 20 years. But protests just aren't what they used to be. In May, I went to a rally in downtown Manhattan against the abortion bans sweeping Republican-controlled states. There might have been 300 people there, far from the thousands you'd expect, given the circumstances. And how many were out in the streets in Atlanta, St. Louis, and Birmingham, Alabama, where virtual abortion bans may soon be in effect? Then on July 2nd, I demonstrated at Representative Rosa DeLauro's office in New Haven as part of a nationwide movement against the government's atrocious treatment of immigrants and asylum seekers. Maybe 200 people showed up. Why is that? Maybe people have their eye on the long game, and the next election is already absorbing our attention. But it feels as if a certain energy is gone. My daughter thinks it's Trump fatigue, that we've been beaten down by the sheer weight of what's gone wrong, from the mountain of lies and scandals to the dismantling of regulatory measures and the packing of the courts with energetic reactionaries. I'd go further. We've internalized a tiny Trump who lives in our heads and jeers at our puny efforts, our letters, our clever memes, and our belief that facts are stubborn things. After all, everyone knows that facts are just fake news. But this is no time to go quiet or to argue about language, as so many have over Ocasio-Cortez's use of the words concentration camps to describe migrant detention facilities. The term is controversial because it compares America to Hitler's Germany when we're still far from it. But perhaps the message is less about Hitler than about those millions of quote-unquote good Germans who didn't do much to stop him. The Nazis controlled society from the ground up and were violent to the point that leafleting could get you executed. We have far less to fear and absolutely no reason to resign ourselves to Trump's cruelties. What are we waiting for? That essay was written by Katha Pollitt, taken from the July 29th and August 5th double issue of The Nation magazine. We have a little time remaining, enough for a couple of letters. First, from a reader in Lincoln, Nebraska, in defense of aesthetes. The reader writes, I found James Macaulay's analysis of Renaud Camus' killer in the article Killer Kitsch of July 1st and 8th, the double issue, broadly persuasive, but I think he's mistaken to claim the aesthete is a natural reactionary. Certain species of aesthete, that's spelled A-E-S-T-H-E-T-E, for example, the fussy period fetishist Camus seems to be, certain species of aesthete do tend that way, and many examples come to mind. Celine, Pound, Riefenstahl, and Marinetti, all of whom Macaulay mentions. But if an aesthete is someone who takes questions of beauty and representation seriously, who meditates as deeply as one can on the means and ends of art, who sees the pursuit of art as braided inextricably with life itself, and, for me, that is what an aesthete is, there is nothing natural at all about the association of the aesthetic with political reaction. There are a great many aesthetes committed to transformative politics and justice. Consider Bertolt Brecht, Charles Olson, W. H. Auden, Pablo Picasso, John Cage, Martha Rossler, and Alice Notley. I could keep going, but let's just cut to the aesthete, Oscar Wilde, and his Soul of Man Under Socialism, Scorn Not the Aesthete. Now, from a reader in South Orange, New Jersey, writing on the imperfect versus the irredeemable, Joe Biden is a flawed candidate with a long list of political liabilities. He would not be my first or even fifth choice for the Democratic nomination. But suppose Biden wins it and stands as the candidate best positioned to reunite the party's black and white working classes, working class bases. Reading Jonathan Kozol's expert deconstruction, Biden and Segregation, in the July 1st and 8th double issue, based partly on an interview from 1975, one can preview the disgust as purists flee to next year's Ralph Nader or Jill Stein. For better or worse, we have binary elections in this country. Next year's will be existential, a choice perhaps between the imperfect and the irredeemable. Today's Republicans may be irredeemably corrupt, but they grasp one essential political reality, solidarity above all. I am not suggesting that we go easy on our candidates, but any one of them would be Lincoln-esque compared with the current president. The Democratic primary field will sort itself out, but let us not hand the enemy an axe. The alternative is 4 more years of white supremacy, climate denial, nuclear brinkmanship, rampant corruption, constitution trampling, immigrant trashing, and much more. That letter from a reader in South Orange, New Jersey. This brings us now to the close of another edition of Alternative Press Review. I'm Randy Goodbungen. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye.